The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to the June edition of Salute a Veteran Every Day. Today, our veteran is Roger Peterson. Roger, thanks for being here.
Happy to be here, Frank. Thank you.
I don't know about your experience after you got out of the military, but people always ask me, where were you stationed?
I was stationed a few places. So,
just give us that list, and then we'll go back and talk about them.
Well, I was on active duty from 1982 to 1992. So that started, I started out after graduating from college in airborne school down at Fort Benning, Georgia, and then the engineer officer basic course at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, right outside of Washington, D.C. My first full tour of duty was with 25th Infantry Division in Hawaii.
Tough
well,
assignment.
Yeah, we deployed a lot from there.
Oh, okay.
But it was a good assignment. Mm-hmm. And then went back to Fort Belvoir for my officer advanced course before heading to West Berlin for 3 years, back when it was West Berlin, working at the Directorate of Engineering and Housing. And from there, I moved down to West Germany to the 8th Infantry Division, the 12th Engineer Battalion. While there, as a company commander, I deployed to Desert Storm, and we were attached to 3rd Armor Division during Desert Storm, that left hook, if you recall, from Desert Storm.
Yeah.
And then I left active duty in 1992 from Germany.
Uh-huh. Let's go back. Let's go way back. How did you decide to come into the Army?
Well, my father was in the service in the Army. I was actually born in Germany while he was stationed there. And so it was always a matter of curiosity for me. And as I was going through high school, I looked at ROTC. He was an ROTC graduate. So I looked at those programs. We lived in Rhode Island, but spent a lot of time in Connecticut. So we drove by the Coast Guard Academy a lot. And we had a friend who was stationed at West Point. So all those, kind of started looking at all those programs, ultimately ended up going to West Point. I majored in math and operations research.
Uh-huh. Were they admitting women at that time?
Yes. Yeah. So I was in the class of 1982. The first class with women was the class of 1980. Mm-hmm. So when I got there, the senior class was the last class. It was all male.
I had the experience of going there and meeting the first woman.
First captain.
First captain.
Okay.
Yeah. Did the advanced work for President Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
And spent a week there.
Okay.
I was very, very impressed with it.
It is an impressive, it's an impressive place physically. I think it's, and obviously I'm a little partial to West Point, but I think you get that feeling when you visit any of the academies, and I visited them all now.
Yeah, I've been to them all too.
But yeah, I have to on record say that since this is being recorded, it is the best of them is West Point.
Yes, I understand. Let's go back to your assignments and flesh those out a little bit. So
sure.
You came in.
I mean, it's pretty standard as you come out of, once you get commissioned, to hit some schools. Yeah. And of course, we were always very interested in just getting to our first three-year assignment, which for me, you're right, I was fortunate. It was in Hawaii, which I had never been to. I grew up on the East Coast of the United States. It was a great assignment, but I wasn't kidding about us deploying a lot. I arrived there in December and left in January for Korea to go there for their winter and spent 6 weeks there. And then by the time June rolled around, I deployed again down to New Zealand for their winter. Mm-hmm. So plenty of cold weather gear that I used while stationed in Hawaii. But, you know, that was the experience of a young 22-year-old second lieutenant, learning from, at that time, this would have been 1982 when I arrived there. I mean, my platoon sergeant, my squad leaders were all Vietnam veterans. So it was a very interesting mix of people to learn from. You know, you had the 18-year-old privates. It was eye-opening, and it was exciting.
Was the time in Korea by chance during Team Spirit?
Yeah, absolutely, it was Team Spirit. Uh-huh. So I went over there for Team Spirit in 1983, and then again in 1985.
I would twice do it. tell the audience what Team Spirit is.
Well, Team Spirit was an annual series of exercises that really were primarily 10 days worth of war games in the northern part of South Korea. And you had forces from a lot of different countries there, primarily the Republic of Korea and the United States. You know, as engineers, we did the things that engineers do. We built obstacles, we built bridges, we cleared obstacles. So we spent, by the time you get there and you bring all your equipment, you're there for about 6 weeks in total. The first time I went, there was also every year they had, at least back then, a reenactment of the breakout from Pusan down in southern port and the southern end of South Korea. So the battalion, infantry battalion I was with, we actually convoyed all the way from Pusan up to the area for these maneuvers. And so it was a couple-day long convoy that I got to experience as a new second lieutenant.
Yeah. Of course, it's all exciting, right?
It is. And, that was my first visit to Asia. And we had a little bit of time afterwards to go do some shopping and a little bit of sightseeing. I did get up to Panmunjom to the DMZ, which was amazing. I don't know if you've been there. It was an amazing experience to go to the site of the talks, the peace talks, the armistice talks. And it was still manned, it is today still an active demilitarized zone, but right. Certainly there was a lot of intensity around it back then. There are incidents. There have been some incidents where a couple soldiers had been killed not a few years before I went there. So,
have you ever flown over in a helicopter?
Not the DMZ in
not
Korea.
Not the DMZ, but Korea, South Korea itself.
We did a couple exercises where we would brought in by helicopter, so that's kind of interesting. Learned a lot about rice paddies.
Mm-hmm. I was amazed. I've been all over by helicopter up there, and it just looks like they're ready for war, ready to go all times.
Well, again, I'm hearkening back to the early 1980s, but... So we stayed on an airstrip, basically, there's still machine gun. The machine guns were there at each end of the runway. You know, when you get up towards the border, even major bridges had machine guns, not necessarily manned every minute, but they were there, and the bridges were were prepared for demolitions if that need be. So, it was.
It's serious business.
It is. It is.
I was stationed at Clark an Air Base in the Philippines, and we were tasked by a United Nations command to make a video of basically to orient new officers, high-ranking officers, because they'd come in, and by the time they learned everything, they'd be going back out. So they wanted us to make a video, and the aerial part of that was I got to go along with my guys, and they have pilots in the cockpit on the runways 24/7, 365, ready to go.
It wouldn't surprise me to hear that was the case. It wouldn't surprise me to hear that it still is. Even I have not been back to Korea since the 1980s, so. Mm-hmm. It definitely, having been stationed, in the continental United States and Hawaii, you get a little bit of a sense in Hawaii, at least with kind of Pearl Harbor and on Schofield Barracks up in the on the mountain range is a place called Kolikoli Pass, which is one of the places where the Japanese cut through kind of under radar and came down the middle of Oahu towards Pearl Harbor, heading to the south. And there's a huge white cross there, and it made you think about, and obviously the Arizona, sure, made you think about this stuff. But to then see it and feel it like it did in Korea was fairly intense.
Now, I'm a little jealous of you and my fellow service members for your trips to Germany. I think I'm the only guy in the Air Force who's never been to Germany. What'd you do over there?
Well, first of all, I loved it. Yeah. I mean, I've lived 8 years of my life there. Two as a as a little baby that I don't remember very well. I was born in Bavaria. But so I went to first to Berlin, West Berlin. So I was there from 1986 to I left in August of 1989. And the wall came down in November of 1989. So, but if you talk about a DMZ, obviously we were surrounded by one in West Berlin.
Yeah.
It was an amazing assignment for me because I was doing construction management for the Army. And so I'm a 26-year-old kid. Here I am. I get in the office, and so my job was to manage some of these construction projects. We had architects. We had inspectors. But a lot of times I was a communications between the whole military and the U.S. organization and then this primarily German. We had 1,000 people in this directorate, and there were six of us were active duty and probably another 20 Americans that worked there. The rest were all German. But I mean, I remember the first project I got handed. Here's your project. And it was to replace the buildings at Checkpoint Charlie. Now, I didn't know much about this. I hadn't been there. But every so often, they replaced the buildings and upgraded them. And so we had our big design meeting. We've got the British are there, the French are there, the German Polizei, obviously the U.S., the State Department's there. And I'm trying to coordinate this discussion. What do you need in this project? And I think it was somebody from the State Department who piped up and said, well, whatever we do, we need to put in there needs to be temporary so that if they take down the wall, we can pull it out quickly. Mm-hmm. And we looked at him like he had three heads. But sure enough, 3 years later, that's exactly what happened and what they did. And so that was my introduction to some of these amazing projects I had the opportunity to work on. You know, obviously our sworn enemies at that point were the Soviet Union, East Germany, and but we actually had a U.S. military liaison mission. Their job was to travel around in East Germany in very clearly marked cars, mm-hmm. And monitor the status of troop movements, East German and Russian primarily. They actually operated out of a building in Potsdam, which was in East Germany. So we went, and it was one of my facilities that I was responsible for. So we're renovating this. It used to belong to the Hohenzollern family, and it's an old carriage house. I call it a small mansion. We go across a bridge that hardly anybody ever went across. This is the Glennikerbrücke. This is where the Gary Powers spy exchange took place. It's called Freedom Bridge. Mm-hmm. But we go over that bridge, go into Potsdam, and we were renovating this building, and our general contractor was the Russian Army, the Soviet External Relations Board. So we would sit and have big vodka. Fancy lunch. I don't know if we had vodka, but we definitely had some food. Uh-huh. I'd talk with this Russian major and say, you know, we need these supplies, and they'd go get them and bring them in. It was a little bit surreal, honestly.
Yeah, okay. So you're a second lieutenant.
Well, at that point, I'm captain.
Captain, okay.
Still a little wet behind the ears, but
still, it's a tremendous amount of responsibility that we're given at an early age.
Oh, that's true. That's true when you think about it that way. Because, and it never really fazed me at the time to look back on it.
Yeah.
Now that I'm a lot older than 26, to look back on it and say, wow, what was I doing? Why did I think I could do this kind of thing? When President Reagan came to Berlin, which was 1987, mm-hmm. I remember getting called over to Building 5. That's where the CIA was. We could just say Building 5. But I get this operations order for his visit. And, uh-huh. and my job was to help arrange for this section of the wall in front of the Brandenburg Gate to be whitewashed so there was no graffiti. Mm-hmm. And then to arrange for it to be guarded so that
no new graffiti
came on except for that graffiti, which was politically acceptable and approved and put on by the CIA. So
do you remember what it said?
No. I don't remember.
Well, you're talking about being looked at like you had three eyes. That's how a lot of people looked at President Reagan when he challenged Secretary mm-hmm. Gorbachev to tear down
this wall. Yeah. It was an amazing time. I had the opportunity to actually visit Russia as a tourist in 1988, mostly with Pan Am pilots. Pan Am was the only U.S. airline that could fly into Berlin back then. It was Pan Am, British Airways, and Air France. Mm-hmm. But so to visit Russia, I had a tourist passport. I was going as just a tourist. It was amazing to actually be here in the belly of the devil,
amazing
so to speak.
Well,
it was just more eye opening. I mean, I was used to going into East Germany. And from West Berlin, we went into East Berlin a lot to shop, to go to shows, to go to restaurants. So I was very comfortable with that experience. Russia took it to a new level. I mean, the first day we were sightseeing in Russia, the KGB came on a bus because somebody had changed some money, black market money changing, and they took a guy off the bus for a whole day. His wife was mortified.
Oh my God.
But he was waiting for us at the hotel at the end of the day.
Wow.
I think they're just trying to send a message
yeah.
to a bunch of Americans.
Yeah, they're not subtle.
No, so.
So, what, where should we jump to next?
Well, you know, for me, it's weird. As much as that was an amazing assignment for me, I was upset when I first found out that's where I was going. While I was at the advanced course in Fort Belvoir, where we got our orders, I'm going to the DEH in Berlin. Well, somebody at my station in life there, we wanted to go be a company commander someplace. So I was not going to be a company commander for 3 years. So I was excited about what I did in Berlin, but anxious to get back to a troop unit. So that's what I ended up doing. I went down, and I asked to stay in Germany. So I was able to get that the branch assigned me in Germany, and I went down to the 8th Infantry Division, 12th Combat Engineer Battalion, and it was a switch from Berlin. I lived in a little wine-making town. This is in the town was surrounded by vineyards. Our concern was surrounded by vineyards. We'd go for our morning PT runs through the vineyards.
I moved there when
I was 28, 29, for a three-year assignment. And
still a captain?
Still a captain, yep. And it took, you know, I was an intelligence officer for a little while, and ultimately then became a company commander, which was typically an 18-month assignment for a captain. And it was an exciting experience. We did a lot of training at some training areas over in the eastern part of West Germany, Baumholder and Vilseck, for those who've been there, Hohenfels. You say those names to somebody that's been in the army in Germany, and they either think of coughing dust or just being covered in mud, because that's all there ever was, it seemed like, there. And I was almost to the end of that 18 months when Desert Storm came around, and Senda was extended in command for another 6-7 months. But it was a great honor to be the leader of a 150 person engineer company. And
under General Powell, no less.
When I got there, he was still. Obviously, as a company commander, it was a couple levels down from.
Yeah.
I think he was 3-star at that point, maybe 4.
We weren't having coffee together.
Yeah, no. I never did see him. I saw him years later in an event, but it was interesting. Obviously, Desert Storm started up in about September of 90, I think. Mm-hmm. And we were training in Hohenfels in November of 90, and on Christmas Eve, I get a phone call to be in the colonel's office at 11 o'clock on Christmas Day. And I was commander of Alpha Company. So I got this phone call first. And I get the company commander from Charlie Company called me a few minutes later. He goes, "Hey, do you get this call from the? You got to be in the colonel's office tomorrow." I said, "Yeah." I said, "What's going on?" I said, "Well, I don't know. Maybe he wants us to go walk through the dying facility and say hi to the troops." So I found out on Christmas Day at 11 o'clock that our unit had been called because they were really looking for a lot of engineer units. Uh-huh. So we were going to be attached to another armor division down in the desert. And we had about less than a month, basically, to get our gear all packed up and shipped off and then take care of all the personnel activities that needed to happen. And obviously this is in the day before cell phones. Yeah. So just getting people back, again, it's Christmas. So yeah. You've got people on leave in the States and you don't have good phone numbers. And we were scrambling just to get in contact with all of our soldiers, never mind get them all back to Germany and get them packed and ready to go. So that was a chaotic time. Plus, at that point, our unit probably was staffed at about 90% of the authorized, which was fairly standard back then. But for us going down the desert, we beefed up. So we picked up another 10, 15 soldiers, many of them straight out of basic training, you know, wide-eyed, bushy-tailed, and said,
Army.
"Listen to your sergeant," you know. Off we go. And then I remember so we were deploying, we were flying down on January 17th. Well, that's the day the air war started. So I get in my car to drive to the base, 2 miles to the base. I turn on Armed Forces Network, and they're reporting that everything has gone down. The air war had started, and if you remember, the early days was a lot of confusion about exactly what had happened. Was Saddam killed? I had soldiers asking me, "Well, are we not going now?" I said, "No, look, you just keep doing what you're doing. Continue to march." They changed. We were supposed to fly in on a big charter 747 or something like that. And they changed our planes because of what was going on. We went on little C-9s maybe, some smaller. My unit ended up on 8 smaller, I think they were Navy aircraft.
Mm-hmm. But Air Force has a C-9.
Yeah, okay. I think it's C-9.
Yeah.
Sounds familiar. So that's what we...
Commercial jet, but yeah.
It was, but yeah, we... So anyway, we... So we... In fact, when we landed down there in Saudi Arabia, is when the first Scud missiles were coming in. So we're on the airstrip, we land, Scud missiles are up there, so our Patriot missiles are now firing at them.
How'd they work?
They worked really well. Now, one of the 8 planes that my unit was on, you know, if you're a pilot and you see some Patriot missiles flying, I suppose that increases the, what we used to call the pucker factor a little bit. So one of the pilots diverted. He went down to Abu Dhabi or someplace. We took us about another week to find those guys. But we're on the bus trying to get into our chemical suits and our gas masks. And
at that time, we saw Saddam as 10 feet tall.
Yeah. And those Scud missiles, we were worried about Scud missiles and carrying chemicals and everything. Mm-hmm. And then we had about 10 days or so to get our equipment and gear collected from the port, put together, and then we convoyed out to the middle of the desert, basically hook up with the 3rd Armored Division and 5th Corps, that element that made the left hook. So we were out on the Iraqi-Saudi Arabia border, Pat, west of Kuwait, basically, for about a week or two while we waited for the green light to go chase down the Republican Guards.
At that time, I was back in Florida at the headquarters for Air Force Special Ops Command, and we were seeing that the Iraqis were greeting the oncoming soldiers and kissing their hand or something like that. They were laying down their guns.
I think, as far as you looked to the left and right, we were just tanks coming across the desert in a straight line. And so you'd come up to a, sp- a, a, a little dugout in the sand where you had 10 soldiers. Well, they put their hands up real fast when they see that coming. And so that happened a bunch of different times. It created confusion for us because we really hadn't had a lot of conversation about how's that going to work.
Yeah.
Generally, the military police or the wartime responsibility is this whole collection of POWs and gathering. But there's this period of time between when the first tank gets to the POWs and when the MPs ultimately can get there, because there's just tons of vehicles moving. And so you kind of had, but what you didn't want to do is just drive by and have nobody watch these guys either, for fear that, you know, maybe they're suicidal, they're decoys, who knows what they're going to do. So it caused us to kind of rethink some things, and there was this continual handing off. So as engineers, we're moving with the tanks in case that they encounter obstacles. Well, we're so far out, there weren't any obstacles. So we were tagged, well, hey, put somebody on these guys until the next group gets here to watch them and then catch back up.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of that, though. And you would go through these, if you went by villages or towns, I mean, the kids were all out there, the families were out there waving and cheering, and but you were always on guard. I mean, we were, you know, constantly anticipating that we're going to run into minefields that are easy to put in the sand.
Yeah. How about the oil fields that were?
Well, all the fires and oil fields. Now, most of that was in Kuwait, so that was to our right, to the east, the oil fields in Kuwait. So we maneuvered all the way around in the west and came into Kuwait in the northern part of Kuwait from the west. We didn't really get too close to all the oil fires until after the ceasefire. You know, we crossed the border on February 24th, I think it was. It might have been 23rd. And then the ceasefire came on the 28th of February. For the next month or so, we were extremely busy as engineers fixing things, building things. Airstrips, gun emplacements for tanks, checkpoints. And at that point, when we were near Basra then in southern Iraq, and we actually, I guess our bivouac site was actually down in Kuwait. So the fires were off, not too far away. You could certainly see them. You could hear them. If the wind shifted and came from the east, then you'd have oil droplets coming down on you. But anybody that was downwind of that stuff, it'd be on everything.
How about the mother of all bombs?
I think during our tank battle in Iraq, Air Force was my friend during came to appreciate, you know, the A-10s and other things that would come in.
Yeah,
I'm glad they're on our team.
And we're at the mercy of the clock, and we've run out of time. Roger, thank you so much for your time and for your service to this country. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after this broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. And all of our past readings are on there, too, and interviews for Salute a Veteran Every Day. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Frank Urban for the North Carolina Reading Service. See you next time.